by the end of this conversation, Mike. So, like, you might be asking the question.
I have built and scaled many businesses, particularly media businesses. I'm a portfolio director. I'm sitting on a number of different boards, very large organisations, things like Scottish Rugby Union and the V&A Museum up in Dundee. I mean, I typically work with emerging founders and CEOs in order to help them find their narrative, land on the right strategy, and implement the actions that will really move the needle for their businesses.
Sounds to me like the dog ate my homework.
Did they sack you?
You can ask me for my feedback now, it's fine.
You don't own that website.
I do own four in that.
Chooseenergysupplier.co.uk, I own.
You own it.
I bought it.
How do you deal with something that's going to be disruptive and bring change to a market?
When you have a very specific issue, very specific challenge, or a very specific opportunity, I'll give you 20 minutes. What's going to get them to swap across to yours?
Mike, welcome to the podcast.
Lovely to be here. Thank you for asking me.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us. We appreciate you taking the time out of your day. I'm very excited for this one. Obviously, there is some intimidation within sitting on this side. I don't know.
Good.
I feel like you might be asking the questions by the end of this conversation, Mike. I want to start with a big question. Who are you and what problem do you solve?
So I'm Mike Souter. I have built and scaled many businesses, particularly media businesses and those around kind of marketing and communications. I am also a kind of a broadcaster of sorts. I'm an inveterate LinkedIn contributor and a top voice there. It's my platform of choice. And I'm a portfolio director. I'm sitting on a number of different boards, very large organisations, things like the Scottish Rugby Union and the V&A Museum up in Dundee, down to smaller, kind of scrappy startups and some scaling quite quickly in fintech and data and contemporary art retail, to name three. What problem do I solve? I mean, I typically work with emerging founders and CEOs in order to help them kind of find their narrative, land on the right strategy and implement the actions that will really move the needle for their businesses. Most kind of startups and scale-ups have a limited capacity. And so it's about prioritizing and making decisions about what you do. You've got 100 different things you can do. What's really going to make a difference? And I guess having been there myself and having worked with countless businesses, CEOs and founders, I'm able to be a good sounding board. In these things, I'm always non-executive. So I've moved from a part of my career where I made all the decisions, which I adored. I absolutely loved that. And kind of still miss that to some degree, but I've moved very much into a non-executive part of my career now, my second career. And that's one in which I don't have the pressure of decision-making. And so that liberates me to be able to help people think through their own issues, their own opportunities, and to make their decisions with my backing.
Nice. Do you work with a variety of like emerging founders, businesses? There'll be a lot of founders, business owners, CEOs listening to this. What symptoms do you think the people at home listening might be facing when it comes to the people that you're speaking to and giving advice? What are the typical symptoms? Where are they going wrong on a day-to-day basis?
I think the places where founders tend to go wrong is they will, and it's understandable, so it's almost too strong to call it wrong, but it's when they lose sight of the longer term ambitions of the organization that they're running, to take advantage of or to pivot around short term threats or opportunities. I think it's, I only get involved really in businesses which have a noble purpose. Like, there are lots of different ways of making money. You make money in lots of cheap and dirty ways, and that's fine. And I wouldn't ever criticize anybody in terms of how they decided to make money, so long as it was legal and it didn't exploit, you know, any vulnerable people. So, you know, you make your money in the way that you want to. Businesses that I like being involved in and get great satisfaction from are those that have a noble purpose, that are here for more than just profit, but profit is a really important part of it. And so I suppose what I'm always preaching with the founders and the CEOs that I work with is to try and tie the decisions that they're making today with what's going to get them to achieve the kind of long-term, glorious, and as I say, noble purpose. I think great enterprises have a noble purpose. They're actually there to make things better for people.
That's interesting. So noble purpose. Could you flesh that out a bit more, maybe an example of what that might look like?
So there's a business that I work with at the moment, and I'm on the board of it. It's called LoopFX, and LoopFX is a fintech. At the moment, the founder, Blair, is in his early 30s. He's a really dynamic guy. He's been plugging away at this now for about 3 years. It is just about to launch. I mean, that tells you the amount of time that you need to build something in the fintech space before you can actually implement it, because you're working with massive institutions that have huge firewalls rightly around them and rules and regulations. So he spent 3 years now with a very small team building this amazing piece of technology. And what it does is it helps traders who are trading large amounts of currency, so 5 to 10 to 100 million pound trades, where they're trading it for other currencies. So it might be, say, a sterling to a dollar transaction. Mm. And at the moment, those transactions can cost a huge amount of money. So a typical $100 million transaction can cost up to £60,000. To transact. And that's just in the risk penalty for trading those things, because the market can move against you. What Blair has done with LoopFX is he has created a matching engine. What that means is that different participants in the trading environment can post their, it's called axes, they can post what they need to trade. And they can find a matching trade or one that will largely match it. That therefore takes huge cost out of the transaction. And what that means is more of the money stays with the traders. When you think about these things, typically these are pension traders. Mm. So they're transferring very large amounts of money because they have to do that on a daily basis. The FX sector is worth $7.6 trillion a day. Wow. That's how much money is traded within it. It is the biggest money market in the world. And it's traded in quite an old-fashioned way. So it's traded between people who always trade with each other. I traded with you, you're a bank, you gave me the best price before, you'll probably give me the best price today. That's not necessarily the case. So it's very much based on kind of human relationships. Mm. What this does is this allows people to trade with full real-time data at their hands. What that does is, that's a great business. It's brilliant for the asset managers and the banks who are involved in it, because they make more money from it. But most importantly, what it means is people's pensions, you know, I mean, 60 to 100,000 pounds is somebody's pension pot, mm-hmm. maybe two or three people's pension pots. That isn't being lost now in the trade. So that's what I mean about a business with a noble purpose. It's got very, very clear commercial targets. It's a very strong, distinctive, unique piece of tech. It should be a massive hit when it works. Well, it does work, but when it's actually in the marketplace, which is kind of imminent, that's over the next quarter, that will be in there. And when it does work, the benefits will be much, much wider than simply for that business and its participants.
That's fascinating. The thing that I jumped to there when I think about that example is things that are disruptive often go against that human bias around change. We often don't want extreme change or disruption in markets, especially really established traditional markets like you're talking about there.
Yeah.
So businesses that you've invested in, maybe when you look at it from like a media and marketing mind as well, how do you deal with something that's going to be disruptive and bring change to a market and get over that so that you can be adopted and seen as a solution?
I suppose in most business sectors, there are incumbents and insurgents. So your incumbents tend to be the market leaders, the very established players, And then your insurgents tend to be the kind of small, nimble, the ones that have very little to lose from doing something which is genuinely innovative. And actually, if you look at yourself and if you're a business and you are neither an incumbent with all that kind of market strength and muscle or an insurgent, then you may well be in trouble. And lots of businesses go through that stage where they are kind of medium-sized and they've got too much to lose by being radical, but they're not big enough to use their market strength to kind of muscle other things around and get the best terms. That's the most dangerous place for any business ever to be in. But back to your question, I think what you've got to do as an insurgent, if you're going to be innovative, is you've got to do things which the big established incumbent players either can't do or would find too painful to do. And we had a great example, the business that I launched, oh crikey, back in 2007 now, so what's that, 18 years ago, was Shortlist Media. And we started off with free, high-quality, high-circulation magazines, which we handed out at Tube Station, Shortlist and Stylist. We moved into digital, we did live events, we moved internationally. You know, we built a business from kind of five of us to 200 of us over about 8 years before I sold the business. And that was a classic insurgent, because we started off with the mindset that we had nothing to lose. Look, I had taken out a mortgage on my house, so actually I did have quite a lot to lose. But you have to start off with that point of view. And so what we did was we innovated on every level that we possibly could. I had come from my previous job, I was on the board of Britain's largest magazine publishing company, IPC. So I knew exactly what it was like to have that incumbent mindset. And I knew exactly what we did to try and put people, our rivals, out of business or to make life really uncomfortable for them. I knew every single lever that could do. I knew the entire playbook. And so what I did was, with my co-founder, Tim Ewington, our starting point was, so what couldn't IPC do? What would blunt all of their tools? What would mean that the normal responses that they have to a competitive threat, they just couldn't do here? And so we did something which was so against their business model. Their business model was, we sell magazines to consumers. We go through a supply chain that uses kind of warehouses and wholesalers. We go into retailers. We spend a lot of money at retailers buying up gondola ends and special offers. We package, you know, we add free gifts to these things. We're all about selling those copies. And then once we've accumulated a readership, then we sell advertisers. We sell that value of those readers to advertisers. And we took that whole thing out of there. We took that whole needing to be in a newsagent out of the whole thing. We created a unique nationwide distribution network. We kept all of the investment in the product, because actually I come from an editorial background, and actually I've realized over the years that great ideas and bad ideas cost the same normally. Like, a bigger budget doesn't mean that you'll have a better idea. Yeah. It's the quality of the idea. It's the quality of the raw ingredients to go in. You can strip that back. Actually, it's even better. So we had a very stripped back, brilliant, multi-award winning set of editorial products. We had a unique distribution network that our rivals in the big established companies couldn't do anything about. I mean, normally, if somebody else launched against them, they'd just buy up all the promotional space in WH Smith's. We couldn't do that here. We went around their whole distribution network. We did deals with agencies, advertising agencies, that they just couldn't do. It was just too painful for them to do. And as a result, we very quickly and very aggressively built a business that was kind of impossible for them to beat with their existing business model. So we were inviting them in and saying, well, if you'd like to launch to our model, our freemium model, that's fine. Bring it on, because we've pioneered this. And it set up a really interesting dynamic, because what it meant was they didn't think it would work. So all the big publishing companies went around and told all their customers, all their staff, Shortlist Media is madness, it'll never work. So it took them a really long time to get around to the idea that actually it was working. It took them a very long time. And they lost that value, but those valuable early few months where if they'd really wanted to, they probably could have put lots more pressure on us, and they just didn't. And it meant that by the time they were ready to compete and launch their own, we were 5 years in. It was just dust by that point. We were so far ahead that they couldn't compete with us. So it taught me a lot about insurgency. Mm. And it also taught me a lot about incumbency, which is if you are determined, if you're a big player and you want to put somebody out of business, you have to go and do it. You have to kill them straight away. I mean, you've got to stamp them out. Let's not mess around here. You've got to do it in the first few months. Don't give them a toehold. They gave us a toehold.
I love that. No, it sounds like they were obviously, and I've heard other stories about that, but like ostriches with their head in the sand, just waiting, thinking, yeah, but it's not going to happen. And by that time, it's too late. I want to go back to something you were saying, Mike, about obviously you remortgaged your house, so maybe what the reality of that was. And I want to talk about risk. So there are entrepreneurs who are taking risks, but there are probably some telltale signs of actually they shouldn't be doing that. It sounds like your risk obviously paid off. What are some of the telltale signs of why people shouldn't be taking risks?
I mean, the people that tend to talk about boldly taking risks are those who say in retrospect, yeah, it worked. And I'm one of those lucky ones, right? If we'd known how difficult it was to build that business, we probably wouldn't have started in the first place. But that wonderful naivety of, well, we can just do this, can't we? Was something once we were in it, we had to do it, you know? And there's kind of something about that. So, you know, most of the successful entrepreneurs that I know, or self-made people, or whatever you want to kind of call them, got there not through taking reckless or uncalculated risks. They got there through taking risks that they had really thought through and had worked through the consequences of it all. I'm a really big believer in trying to make your mistakes quickly and cheaply and in private, because the opposite's horrible. And so the people I know who are the smartest people who take those risks are the ones who don't jump into it. They've seen an opportunity and they've thought about it and they've done their scenario planning really carefully and they've thought about what's the contingency here and what if. The people who take risks recklessly, often the common theme is that they've underestimated the competition. It's very easy when you come up with an idea to think, well, nobody else does this, or I'm going to do this better than everybody else. So one of the questions that I always ask somebody who comes to me with a kind of a new business concept is, tell me really crisply why this is different to and better than anything that exists. And the people that come back to me that demonstrate that they respect their audiences, the people that come back to me that can demonstrate that they respect their competitors, that they don't underestimate them, are the ones that make me sit forward. I think, okay, you might have something here. You still believe your idea is good, but you've been able to demonstrate why your competitors are good. You haven't underestimated them, and that tends to be the biggest flaw in most new business ideas.
So there's people that will be thinking, right, I've got a new business idea, great, and I've got this idea, I've done a bit of market research, I know why we're better than X, Y, or Z, or why they worked and what we're going to take from them. When it comes to, it feels like a lot of entrepreneurs are probably lacking action. When it comes to action, what would be the advice you would give to somebody in terms of starting? What are the first steps when it comes to generating your first customers or bringing in your first partnerships?
That's a good question. So a lot of entrepreneurs keep everything, a lot of would-be entrepreneurs keep everything to themselves. And often it's because they're afraid that somebody else is going to steal their idea. I have to say, in my many, many, many years in business, I've never really come across any examples of somebody else stealing somebody else's idea, because ideas are ideas. I mean, if you're not having 20 new ideas every single day, forget about the idea of being an entrepreneur anyway, right? Just, you know, entrepreneurs are typically people, enthusiastic, positive-minded people who go, oh, I think this is an opportunity, or this is an opportunity, right? So don't get caught up in an idea. you know, as being the most valuable thing. The most valuable part of an idea is the implementation. So all the work that you do after you've had the idea is about that implementation. That should already give you that plan, that first step. What are you going to do? But part of that is you have to speak to other people. You have to speak to people that you trust, people who you trust to give you straightforward, honest advice, you know, that it's going to be unvarnished and you're not actually asking them to be really nice to you and, you know, tell me it's a really good idea, but, you know, tell me what the flaws are. You don't want that. You just want people who go, oh, have you thought about this? Or have you thought about that? And you need to go and speak to customers. You need to validate what you're going to do. And every business has customers. And there have to be ways that you can find to go and speak to them before you make the big decision that you're going to press ahead. In order to go and speak to customers, you need to be able to bring an idea to life, whatever it happens to be. If it's a new product or it's a new media brand or it's, you know, a new insurance service, you need to be able to find a way to articulate it tangibly so that you can sit down with somebody so that it's not just a case of I'm going to sit down with you, Zach, and I'm going to explain my idea. That's one part of it. Show them the idea. Mm-hmm. Bring it to life. And do it in such a way you go, I've done some drafts here of some things. I'd love your thought on it. Because the other thing about it is if you present somebody with an idea that's too polished, you've already tried to sell it. Mm-hmm. You're already selling it in. You're already starting to cover up the potential flaws within it. So try and do something in a way that you go, it's kind of just an idea that I've had in a slightly casual way. Oh, these look interesting and good. What do you think of this? What do you think of that? What do you think other people would do? What would competitors do? What would get you to use this rather than what do you use at the moment that's like this product? What would make you stop using that and start using this? Which, by the way, is the other point to make. People often, when they're launching a new business, underestimate inertia in customers' habits. So to get a customer to adopt your product or service means they need to disadopt something that they are already doing, unless it's completely new and there aren't that many of those. Mm. Do you know what I mean? There aren't that many totally, totally new concepts and new ideas. So it's what's going to get them to swap across to yours? What are the incentives? What's the customer experience or the user experience or the journey going to be like into that? But bring it to life.
Fascinating. Is there, so then we're kind of padding it out a little bit there. Is there other boxes that need to be ticked that make something or someone investable? Are there things that you spot every time that you think, amazing, you ticked all those boxes for me. That's exactly what I need to see every single time.
Yeah, I mean, I've probably talked about the most important ones, which is respect for competitors, the ability to show an idea and not just tell it, the understanding of what makes a product distinctive and genuinely better. This needs to be different and it needs to be better. And that's a deceptively simple sounding question. If that doesn't take you 3 weeks of full-time work to come to the answer of, you probably haven't come to the answer of it. If you've got all of those things, that's really important. What else makes you personally investable? I think, most entrepreneurs are really good salespeople. Salespeople come in all shapes and sizes. People kind of have an image of a salesperson, don't they? Do you know what I mean? Somebody who's a bit flash.
Gives the gap, yeah.
But actually, it's, you know, a good salesperson is somebody who is logical and persuasive and calm in the moment, who's good at listening and demonstrating that they listened. So I think, you know, they have to be that. I'm really interested in if somebody wants to be invested in, really interested in their past, in their history, really interested in their contemporary experience of the marketplace that they're launching into. Now that ties into understanding and respecting competitors. So I wouldn't say if you didn't come from that industry, you're not investable. But if you do come from an industry and you can see the flaws within it, and you can demonstrate why your product is different and better, that's a plus. That's a plus on there. And you're looking for leadership qualities. You know, what is this person like as a communicator? What are they like under pressure? Are they sufficiently numerate to be able to grasp the way that numbers will move? Do they understand the basics of a business and how you can be distracted by revenue and if you're not focused on cash flow, you can go out of business? Are you a person who, you know, are you a fireman? Do you, a fire person?
It's 2024.
Are you a fire thing? No. So, are you part of the fire service and do you jump out of a fire engine and run towards the fire? I am looking for that as well. Mm. I'm looking for people who confront problems and issues. And confront good things as well, but people whose instinct is to step forward. I think that's really important. And people who understand that, especially in a new business, they need to make decisions. They need to make decisions quickly and in the absence of full data. And that is often what separates a really good leader from an okay leader. Because they recognize that their job is to keep decisions flowing up and down through their organization and outwards. And weak leaders will typically hold on to decisions because they're afraid to make them, not quite articulate what decision they've made, kind of lay it out there, not come to a final decision on things, thinking about this. That's not to say you should jump into every decision that you make. But it is to say that you have to make decisions, and then you have to then live with those decisions and maximize them if they're good decisions, or pivot out them really quickly if they're bad decisions, and not have an ego about it. And that, for me, is the bit that I miss about not being a CEO anymore. You know, I haven't been a CEO for a long time now, but that was the thing I loved more than anything else, because that was the seat of power, right? Power is a great thing. It's a marvelous thing. But the thing that gives you power is that you are the decision maker. Mm-hmm. And using that power really well to accelerate the speed of the business rather than slow it down. To liberate people to do great work rather than kind of keep them in line. Oh, I loved that.
So I think we're moving nicely on to scaling, right? So I imagine someone who works with you, if they're an emerging founder, there's probably some scaling that has to happen when they start working with you. What do you think are the most kind of overlooked things that we aren't talking about when it comes to scaling?
It's a really interesting question to do with scaling. If you had asked me this question 2 years ago, I'd have said that the key to scaling always is in moving from generalists, because that's what you tend to start with, a bunch of people all together who do 20 different jobs each just to get it done, just to get it over the line, and move into specialists, people who can accelerate the speed of the business by bringing their expertise and their insight and their contacts and everything else. I'm not saying that specialism and expertise is redundant anymore, but we're moving into a new era, and it's an era which is driven by AI. There's a really interesting business, which I don't know if you've heard of, and it's called Gamma.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we use it.
Yeah.
Okay, brilliant. It's an incredible tool, right? They've spent the last 15 months in cash positive, profitable territory. It's run by one guy and 27 other people. And he employs generalists who use AI to do the specialist work. So he has people across his organization, design teams here and sales teams there, and they are using the power of AI agents within their organization. So you could argue that they are AI specialists, but I think they're probably generalists. So I think what we're doing is we're moving into now a new era where scaling may be not so much to do with a new organizational diagram that has lots of specialist silos within it, but is more to do with how do you have human directing AI agents all over the place. And that might mean a new era of super generalists. That's kind of what I don't know yet, but it's kind of, I'm starting to think that the frontier firms of the next 10 years will adopt that approach, the gamma approach, more than that traditional conglomerate approach with specialists in.
It's an exciting time, and I think we're right at the forefront of it, and there are going to be so many million and billion pound companies that are run by one or two people, and I think that we're going to see that massively. So it ties in nicely with like the AI piece, and I know that you do like a lot of mentorship. We've been talking a lot about like, do we use AI for mentorship, like, or do we use like traditional forms of media like podcasts, videos, YouTube, books and stuff like that? Or do you actually get a real life mentor or coach? I imagine your emails and DMs on LinkedIn are flooded with people saying, can I have a 5-minute coffee chat with you, Mike?
Yeah.
So when are people at the best position to ask for help, and how should they ask for that help appropriately so that they don't piss you off?
Yes, I have far more in the way of requests for, could I just have 5 minutes of your time, or could I have 15 minutes, or could you just take a look over my business plan, than I can ever deal with. And I have to, I'm always very flattered to be approached by people, and it never makes me grumpy, because I can remember being in that position myself. I will typically have to explain to people that 5 minutes with me isn't any use, neither is 15.
Yeah.
If I'm going to be able to genuinely give value into somebody's business proposition, so there's a business plan there, you know, there's an MVP, I'm going to need to spend, I don't know, a couple of days understanding that. I'm going to need to spend another couple of days understanding the competitive environment. I'm going to really need to do my due diligence on it before I sit down with them and do an hour's worth of consultancy. Now, I do that, but I do that as a paid role, and it tends to be typically large corporations who do that. They pay me a lot of money to do that, which is wonderful. But they pay me a lot of money because it takes up a huge amount of time and capacity. So there's kind of no such thing as, can you just take a quick look at my deck and tell me what you think? It's just not, yes, I can, but the advice will be useless. And that's a waste of everybody's time. I think if you're looking for mentorship, I will often say to people, when you have a very specific issue, very specific challenge, or a very specific opportunity, I'll give you 20 minutes, but hold on to that, right? I definitely don't say this to everybody. I'm really not looking forward to all the DMs, but if I will sometimes say to people, look, here's, it's like a gift token. Do you know what I mean? You can have 20 minutes of my time, but think about it, be really clear about it. This is a one-off thing. We'll do a Zoom call. You'll tell me what it's all about. I'll give you my take on it. And then we move on from there. Because I want people to still feel supported. I think if you're looking for mentorship, then you need to be very clear about the time commitment that you are after. You need to be realistic about what a mentor can do for you. A mentor isn't going to be somebody who's, they're not a spirit guide, you know. They're not gonna be with you the whole time like Obi-Wan, then Kenobi, popping up at crucial moments. You need to be really clear that if you're looking for mentoring on, let's say, fundraising or sales strategy or, you know, a very specific HR issue, those things, it's much easier to ask experts for that because they can see a start and an end. You know, mentor comes with it for the mentors rather than the mentees, sometimes an uncomfortable feeling of, am I signing up here to something that's just going to go on and on? Do you know what I mean? Am I kind of on the hook here for the next few years every time there's a problem? And you know, most people, you'd be surprised what people will do if you just ask. You know, I've been lucky in my career that people have helped me when I've asked them to, which is why I'm always really keen when I can to do the same thing. You know, I find difficulty saying no. When I say no to somebody, like a little bit of me dies. I love saying yes. I've said yes to you to come to all the way out to Putney. Cheesy peeps. You know, I like to say yes to things. I'd much rather be doing that. So make it easy for people to say yes to things by being being specific but realistic. No 15-minute business plans. That's not realistic, even though that's specific. This is the thing I'd really like to know. I've researched you. I'm pretty certain you could help me with this. Could I have 15 minutes on this? That is much more likely to get a yes.
I think that's brilliant advice. And you mentioned due diligence there. Obviously, we couldn't have you on and not talk about The Apprentice. But before we jump into that, I was looking into probably some of the most searched terms on YouTube when it comes to corporate business. And I think one of the things that you'll be the best person to answer is people are petrified of job interviews. They don't know how to prepare. They don't know how to get their mindset right. They don't know whether they should be asking questions, how they should be answering questions. So this is probably like a prequel to all the apprentice questions that we want to ask you. How should people get prepared for a job interview?
I think job interviews are quite a different process now than they were even 10 years ago. You know, when I speak to people who are going through job interviews, a lot of this now is kind of online. Lots of it is, you know, job interviews in a group with lots of different people. I'm not the best person to tell you how to cope with those things because it's not something I've ever been on either end of. But I'm sure there are probably lots of good tips out there for you. I think what I can probably advise is when you do get to that moment where you are in the room with somebody, preparation is incredibly important. In the first instance, do dress for the job that you want and do turn up the best possible version of yourself, the most enthusiastic, the most energy generating version of yourself that you can possibly be, because you've just got that one chance. And frankly, if you can't raise your game for that, then people aren't going to give you a job. Do you know what I mean? You know, if he or she can't be bothered to really make that obvious effort, yeah. So you can't make too much of an effort when it comes to those things, because that's your opportunity to make an impression. I think do your research properly. Often people do the easiest research, the stuff that's on page one of Google. I mean, if I'm preparing to interview somebody, I don't know, say for The Apprentice, I'd probably start on page 39 of Google. That's where all the interesting stuff is. It's where all the old stuff that's been pushed away that people haven't been able to hide sits. So really properly do your research, ideally on the person you're going to meet and also on the company that you're going to work in and on the job that you're going to do. And most interviewers respond well when people are candid about the challenges that they faced and how they surmounted those challenges. So again, it's use your imagination. Think about the sorts of challenges that you might face when you actually get to that job. Mm-hmm. Think about examples in your own past where you face something, you've stumbled, but you got back up again and you managed to, you know, whatever it happens to be. You need to be really clear about your narrative. What do you want people to think about you? That's the one thing, you can control. You can't control anything else. What's the impression that I want to leave? What do I want people to think about me? What do I want people to remember about me when I'm gone? You need to go in there knowing those things and then allow the interviewer to guide the conversation in whatever way. And then you need to be strategically smart enough to know when to drop those things in. you know, you can't sit down and go, before you start, let me tell you everything about myself. That's not there. You need to know that stuff. You need to be confident with it. And then you need to really enjoy the interview, because an interview is an amazing opportunity to talk about yourself. And people don't get that opportunity much.
Nice. I'm going to do a movie called, I think it's called Inversion. Are you ready for this?
Mm-hmm.
So we talked about the interviewee.
Yeah.
Often when I speak to the interviewer, they're saying, particularly with salespeople, I interviewed this guy, he's amazing, can't wait for him to start. And then they're like, who's this person who started? They're totally different than who I interviewed. Kind of didn't show up the same way that I expected. So how do we as interviewers make sure that we're asking the right questions, steering the conversation the right way to make sure the person who shows up is the same person that showed up to the interview as them, as their best self?
Wow. I mean, I think that has to come from experience, doesn't it? And it has to come from taking references, and it has to come from the due diligence that you do on the other side of things. If somebody is so different to the person that you interview, then yeah, you've been properly mugged off there, haven't you? But it probably means that you haven't spent the time to speak to people who've worked with that person before and really get into it. You know, there's a habit of getting, you know, kind of search executives to do the you know, that chasing up on people and getting references. I mean, never do that. Never, ever. Never, ever get somebody else to do that. You've got to pick up the phone. You've got a written reference from somebody. That looks pretty good. Do you mind if I call you? That'd be great. And you spend 10 minutes on the phone. You will find out more in the pauses than you will from what people say. People often won't give a bad reference, but if you ask the right questions, they will fail to say the things that they would have said about somebody if they were really good. At which point, if you're at that stage where you're taking references, you're probably offering somebody a job subject to references. If those references don't check out, get the person back in again. And just say, look, you know, I need to speak to you again, because actually I've picked up on some references and there's some points on here that I want to satisfy myself on for moving forward.
Nice.
It's fine. It's a big, you know, it's a big decision for both sides. You know, nobody themselves wants to be in the wrong job, a job that they're not really suited for.
Of course not.
And you definitely don't want, as the hiring manager, to hire the wrong person. I had this really good hiring tip the other day, which was to do with batch hiring. It's not possible for lots of organizations, but certainly size, when you get to a certain size of organization, often you can be hiring kind of 10 people at once. And often that might be, particularly if that's kind of, you know, school leavers or university leavers, you know, graduates or whatever. Lots of organizations do it where they get different people to hire, 10 different people hire 10 candidates. Of course, what they do is they hire to the average expectation of what that candidate should be. So they end up with 10 very similar candidates. So if you give one person the role of hiring all 10 candidates, then once they've satisfied themselves, they've got 4 or 5 people who kind of fit the kind of average, they'll start to choose people who will be a bit more around the spectrum of those things. So you end up with a much better diversity of hires if you let one person in your organization hire the new batch of graduates.
Wow. And it's solely their responsibility.
Yeah.
So yeah, interesting.
Okay. I mean, they, you know, they might use other people, you know, around the business to get, but they make the decision.
Yeah.
Because what they'll do is, because what people do is, people don't want to be the hiring manager that hired the dud.
Yeah, of course.
And if you've only got one person to hire, you're going to hire the person that you think most matches all of the criteria. And that might sound like a really good thing, but 10 of those people, that's really bad for your culture. But if you're the hiring manager and you've hired 10 people and you're really certain that 5, 6, 7 of them are definitely going to work out, you're going to start taking risks on other people. And they're sometimes the people who are the really unexpected superstars that you wouldn't otherwise have got into your culture and into your business that do amazing things.
Yeah, we've had a lot of those, haven't we? The dark horses. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's get into The Apprentice. I'm sure you've been asked every question under the sun about it, but
let's see if we can come up with some new ones.
Let's try. Could you take us all the way back then? How did you get involved?
No, I've been asked that one.
You've been asked that one. No, how did you get involved?
Okay, I'll tell you. So back when I was running Shortlist Media, we were in, I think, our second or third year. We were clearly a success in the industry. We were being written about, but we hadn't quite broken through at that point. And I got a call from two researchers for a BBC business programme who wanted to come and see me. So they sat down and they explained that they were researching tasks for Series 7 of The Apprentice. And they were wondering, was there something they could do with magazines? So they were going to go around and speak to different magazine people. And I thought, this is an amazing opportunity. And so I pitched them our business model, our freemium business model, very different to everything else. It's the emerging trend. And they're kind of sitting forward and this is really interesting. I said, and I've watched every episode of The Apprentice up until then, massive super fan. So I said, well, you know, it's a great task. The teams come in, they both create magazines for different sectors. You can give them kind of different, you know, different types of audience they should be going for. My organization came from, Shortlist Media came from a different company I had called Crash Test Media, which was really a development company. So we developed ideas really quickly. We would develop and test and then redevelop things all the time for big media companies. And so we were used to turning prototypes around really quickly. So I said, well, get the teams to come in. They can shoot some their covers. They can do this. Or give them designers. They can lay out all these pages. We'll get their magazines printed overnight. Then the next day, they can take them out to focus groups. They can take them to advertisers. And then whoever gets the most advertising money wins the task. Whoever doesn't, one of you will get fired. So we ended up winning the opportunity to host that task. They came in months and months later and they shot it. And when they were shooting it, they said, look, Mike, could you stand there, the top of the set of stairs we had as you came into our building, and just speak to the candidates, just tell them a little bit about magazine publishing. I was like, sure, okay. So I stood there and did this thing. They were like, thanks very much. And then 2 days later, I got a call from the series editor saying, we love that. You know, that went, we're really confident we've got some great stuff there. Alan would like to meet you. Are you free tomorrow? I said, yes, of course I'm free tomorrow. Striking out whatever I'm doing. So I'd never met Alan before. So I went to meet him. So I was fascinated. Went to meet him. And he spent 40 minutes basically grilling me on my background, on the business, how it was funded, who owned what equity, to the point where I'm thinking, is he about to make an offer for the business? This has taken a turn I wasn't expecting. But then he did the big reveal and he said, look, this is the first season, season 7, where the prize for the winner changes from being a job with a salary with me to an investment. I'm going to invest £250,000 in it. So I'm looking for some people with an entrepreneurial background to refresh my interview panel. Have you watched the interview episode? I'm like, yeah, course I have, yeah. So he said, well, if I asked you, would you do it? Yeah, sure. So I got it and I thought, this is an amazing thing. I'll do this, you know, this will be a year. What, you know, it's a great thing to tell the grandkids. And then about a week before the second series, they called me again. Well, you are free next Sunday, aren't you, to come and do the interviews? So whether they had somebody else in mind who dropped out or not, I've got no idea. But anyway, I got the second year and I thought, right, I've got to get the third year. Because otherwise, I'm always going to think that I did the first year, wasn't that great. Because, I mean, you can't be. I mean, you walk into something like that, it's a very alien environment. You're not going to be great straight off the bat. So I thought, right, after year two, I have to get year three. So I kind of can satisfy myself that I was good enough. So anyway, I've been doing it now for 13 years. It's an amazing privilege. You know, I still think it's an incredible show. It inspires so many people, you know, so many entrepreneurs. It's a great door opener, you know, it's a great icebreaker. You know, I was at Mansion House last night for the UK government's business and trade dinner, and I'm sitting next to somebody who I won't name, but they're very, very recognisable, very successful CEO. And all they wanted to talk about was The Apprentice last night. So it's a great icebreaker for conversations. I really enjoy doing it.
People will be fascinated behind, like, with what happens behind the scenes. So 13 years, So what has changed? Obviously, we only see snippets of you asking some of the best questions and some of the best bits of telly. What has changed in that period from behind the scenes, and what actually goes into it?
So what goes into it is I get the applications to be part of the process, the business plans and the CVs of the final five plus a couple, because they're still in the middle of shooting the previous episode before I get there. So when I first get the batch of these things, there's more than five. So I'll start to go through them. I basically spend a lot of a week before I go in to interview them, understanding those things, understanding different sectors, because typically it will be somebody working in waste disposal, somebody else working in hair extensions, somebody working in, you know, the sectors are not things I'm an expert in, but I have to make myself an expert in by the time I'm sitting in front of, or they're sitting in front of me. I'll do my work really carefully. I'll make notes of my, don't really do questions, but I do kind of lines of inquiry, starting points, things I'm really interested in. I'll mark up the business plans. I have a sixth sense for when somebody's making something up or exaggerating something, or they're unlikely to be able to back it up. And that's probably because I've done it now so frequently. You know, once you've done 60 plus of these interviews, you get a real sense of the way people are. And then I'll go in there, you know, armed with those things. And, you know, it is, you would think that it was a kind of an artificial thing, but it's not really. I mean, you've got, you know, we're there on a floor plate of some enormous building, you know, in the middle of the city of London. And there's my table, and there's my chair, and there's the chair for the candidate. And I'm sitting there, and they will walk in, and there will be many people in the room, because you've got cameramen and sound technicians and runners and everything else. But as soon as the candidate sits down, I'm completely unaware of any of that. Not aware of cameras. I'm not aware of anything or anybody else apart from that person. And what I'm there to do is to try and get to the bottom of it. And my motivation as I'm doing it is, I want to make sure that the right, Alan invests his money in the right person, and it's my job to stop the wrong person getting through.
And how do you prevent, I was going to say, how do you prevent your own personal biases from getting in the way when it comes to industries or past experience? How do you make sure?
I'm pretty objective about these things. If somebody can make a good claim for something, for sure, if it's a business that I've been in, a type of business I've been involved in the past, I can bring some of that to the debate. I'm probably long enough in the tooth now to have a broad understanding of what it means or what you need to do to be successful in different industries. So again, if somebody can prove that their business is different to and better than, if somebody can show that they have the metal to be able to surf over the different problems that they'll have, if somebody can prove that they understand how good their competitors are, which they never can, then then I'm really up for the cup. And I really like them. I will put them under pressure. This is the first part of the process where they can't throw somebody else under the bus. It's the very first time where they can't go, well, actually, Zach's fault that we lost that task. This is your work. I mean, if they want to tell me it wasn't their work and somebody else wrote their business plan, I'm really interested at that point. So it's their work, so they can't get away from that. And I know the strengths and weaknesses of their business plan because I probably know it better than most candidates do by the time they're sitting there.
Is there a drive in the interview for the gotcha moment, or recognizing I need the good bit of TV, or does any of that come into it?
Not really. I mean, occasionally there are moments where I will reflect in that bit that sits at the back of my brain, oh, that's going to end up on television. but it's not why I do it, and that's a byproduct of the whole thing. You know, I want to make people uncomfortable during that, because that's part of testing their character. It's part of testing, because, you know, I've been through, and it's not a job interview. It's a business pitch. Mm-hmm. And they are pitching to a proxy for an investor. And I have pitched so many things to so many investors. I've been involved in so many pitches. I've pitched to VCs and private equity companies, and they are, you think I am a bit ruthless. They are brutal. If something doesn't float their boat in 5 minutes, then it's thanks very much. I mean, you can be in the middle of talking and thanks very much. That's great. They'll close up their things. We need to go now. So, I mean, I'm, you know, I don't bring any of that kind of frank rudeness into there. And actually, I'm never rude. I mean, I'm not a person who likes to be rude. I can be a little bit abrupt sometimes, but I like to respect the fact that the candidates that are there have gone through the white heat of competition. I mean, what they've had to do to get to that stage, and they're really determined by that point. And I really respect the fact that they've had the tenacity to stay in it until then. And so, you know, I want to give them a fair crack of the whip. And I'm really happy for them to argue back. Really happy. If they think I've got something wrong, I love that, because I don't.
Is there any game planning that happens with the other people who are doing the interviews? Do you have any kind of pre-chat, or you don't know what each other's going to go through?
No, I mean, there's a kind of a broad understanding that Claudine Collins will probably spend quite a lot of time on people's personalities and their backgrounds, and that's great. She's brilliant at that. Claude Littner will be very forensic when it comes to cash flow analysis and, you know, revenue assumptions and the fine detail of the cost base that sits underneath something that Linda will shout at people. and therefore, I suspect we probably, you know, I do the things I'm naturally interested in, which are typically the things that are about using your imagination to think what might happen in the future. Mm-hmm. So I try to place all businesses in a real life setting, I suppose. Mm-hmm. That's the context that I like to speak to them about. So, you know, I typically ask questions rather than make statements. It's only when somebody's really trying to deny something that I'll say, you are fooling yourself now. But most of the time, I will just ask questions. That's my job. I interview people. And that's, you know, where I came from as a journalist when I was 17 years old up in Dundee. You know, that was what I was taught to do. Just, you ask open questions and you lead with that. And then you get people to tell you the answer. And then you help summarize it. So what you're saying is this. Okay, that's great. So all I'm doing is I'm just building their story with them. I'm building it on what they tell me.
And they'll trip themselves up along the way, I'm sure.
Sometimes.
Up, yeah. I want to talk to you about LinkedIn. Mm-hmm. You said it was your social media of choice. And when I said the word, you smiled, Mike.
Yeah.
So talk to me. What's your relationship like with LinkedIn? Why is that your social media of choice?
So probably two and a half years ago, I hated LinkedIn. I just found it full of really dreadfully boastful, you know, dull content.
Didn't know you followed Jack.
Hey! Very good.
So therefore, I just didn't go anywhere near it. But then two things happened. One was I thought, come on, I come from a media background. I come from a content creation background. I've got to be the change that I want to see. That was the first thing. The second thing was the realization that, you know, when you run a business, you have a business card, and it means that when you walk into a new situation, they say, "Oh, what are you? I'm the chief executive of Charlotte's Media, or I'm chief executive of the Evening Standard, or whatever." And that's not because you're going to spend all night talking about it. It's just people go, "Oh, right, brilliant." Anyway, and then you'll talk about whatever you're going to talk about. Mm-hmm. And I started to find that it was really difficult to summarize what I do when I go in there. And it made me realize that I don't have a singular place where people can go if they want to check me out, if they want to find out about me. I don't have a kind of a repository for my kind of different professional interests. And you know, Instagram isn't the place for that. That's for personal. I'm not on X anymore because it's incredibly toxic, and just puts me in a very bad mood. So LinkedIn became that place, and so I thought, right, I've now got two real motivations. One is I want this to be somewhere where I am proud to be, and secondly, I want to do things I would be really interested in reading about that would perk my interest, that would be memorable. So I started to do that, and I'd probably got through my work and through things like The Apprentice, you know, 18 months, 2 years ago, I was at about 5,000 followers. I'm now at about 33,000 followers. I'm very happy for all of your listeners to follow me as well. The more, the merrier. I'll answer all of their comments, I promise. It's been a place it's been an extraordinary place for opportunities. So I get kind of speaking opportunities from it. All sorts of different things come up from it. And I find the real power of LinkedIn is not really what happens on the platform, but it's the in real life stuff. So it's back to when I walk into a new situation, or I walk into a boardroom, I will end up speaking to people about something. They will end up asking me about something that I've posted. And then afterwards, if I check up, often they haven't liked it and they haven't commented on it, but they saw it. Mm. So I'm aware that LinkedIn is this extraordinary amplifier of voice. Even if it's not measurable in that sense, my own experience of it is it allows me to be able to set out my stall. And just like somebody in a job interview, the only thing I can have any control over is my narrative, what it is that people take away, what it is that people think about me. So this is my opportunity to project that. These are the things that I care about. These are the things I'm enthusiastic about. These are the things I think are important.
Lovely. Mike, I've absolutely loved this conversation. It feels like if people want to check you out, the best place is to go and find you on LinkedIn. Is there anywhere else that you want to drive people to, or any messages that you want to push towards people?
No, please do come and join me on LinkedIn. The great thing about LinkedIn is it's all free. I've just launched a newsletter, which is sitting alongside a LinkedIn video, a LinkedIn learning video course. I've become an accredited LinkedIn learning instructor.
Wow.
Which is great. Thank you very much. I was going to wear my sash. It's in the dry cleaners. And that means that it allows me to, I've kind of gone through an accreditation process, so it allows me to do coaching videos on LinkedIn. So my very first coaching video series will drop any day now. I'm working with a guy called Patrick Shea Stanford, who runs an agency working with business leaders called Prolific Voices. And he is an ex-LinkedIn executive. So we've kind of teamed up him with his strategic insight and his kind of expertise about the platform, me with my kind of boardroom experience and my experience of building businesses and being at kind of a C-suite level. And we've come together to create a 10-part series, which is about building your business credibility on LinkedIn. Because my real life observation is so many very senior leaders are very afraid of LinkedIn and therefore don't post. And by not posting, they are doing themselves a disservice, they're doing their teams a disservice, and they're doing their clients a disservice. And I get where that anxiety comes from. And this is a course that aims to build their confidence and kind of break that down and get more of them on there.
Nice. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Mike.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you.